welcome back to Logic Gate, where we're discussing the Star Wars TV show Andor on Disney Plus. As always, I'm your host, Scott, and I'm joined by my two friends, Doug.
Hello there.
And Jason.
That's me.
Whenever you're listening to this, whatever time of day it is, we are discussing Andor Season 1, Episode 9. The title is Nobody's Listening!
Nobody's listening!
Nobody's listening!
Except Dan and Becky. We appreciate your support.
Nice. And Bailey, I want to shout her out again.
Oh, yes.
So I just want to shout out Bailey because she's on it. She was keeping track of the blue characters and the red characters.
Good job, Bailey.
And she, like, immediately, she counted them in her head, like, quickly. And then now she's, like, obsessed with this for some reason. So I love it.
Big thanks, Bailey. Be sure to like and subscribe.
Bailey, my daughter.
7-year-old daughter, right.
7-year-old daughter, yes. For the other two fans.
for the fans that are unfamiliar. Not Jason's parents, yes. Yeah. All right. Real quick, I have just a little bit of errata from the last episode. I did some quick research on IMDb, and at least as of right now, Forrest Whitaker only has credit for one episode of Andor. I was really hoping they were going to bring his character back for some more, but at least as of right now, he is only credited on the last episode. So,
yes, and I did a little bit of research on Saw Gerrera it definitely enlightened me on like his position where there was an episode of Clone Wars where he was part of an anti-separatist resistance group, and the separatists killed his sister. So it elucidated the fact that he's very anti, or he infights a lot with the different rebellion fractions, especially separatists. So
we talk, the word separatist comes up in this, and it comes up in Clone Wars too. And so I looked up the definition of it, and a separatist is one who secedes or advocates separation from a group as from a nation or an established church. And the second definition is one who advocates cultural, ethnic, or racial separation. So I think the implication here, calling people separatist, is because there is no formal rebellion yet. I mean, we haven't quite got to that stage. I think these separatists are probably, this is just like rebellion version 1.0. They're ramping up to that.
Yes. Yeah. I think they're like the original rebellion, or, you know, anti-imperialist, as far as I am aware. Yeah,
I think they're the rebellion before they get formally organized.
Or at least one faction of it. I mean, I think they're probably one of the oldest factions. Yeah.
No, I would agree with that. I think that was kind of illuminated in that conversation between Luthen and Saw Gerrera, is that there are several anti-imperial factions, right, but they don't all work together. They don't all agree with each other.
Anything else before we dive right into the episode?
Well, the intro music.
Isn't that technically in the episode?
Well, I don't think we
read. Did you just dive? I think you just dove right into the episode.
There we go.
Kick us off, Nuge.
Well, see, okay, so like it's a shot of space. This, you know, and then some letters like slowly come into view.
What are the letters?
Well, you can't tell at first.
Uh-huh.
It took me a while, but then slowly it's like sort of, it says Andor.
I like how we're 9 episodes in and we're explaining the intro that's on every show.
But I mentioned last episode that every intro is slightly different, and these last two have been vividly different. Now that I know this, maybe, but this one was quite a bit different. It was more upbeat, more like hopeful, uplifting in a way. So it's kind of an interesting like tone check for possible upcoming episode.
Is that a common thing that I mean, I'm just thinking of all the sitcoms and everything I've ever watched, and like the intro music or the whatever is always the same, right? I mean, it's got to be a lot of work to come up with new music for every single episode.
Yeah, I can't think of a show off the top of my head that has like a different. Right, I mean,
you know what I'm talking about? Like Cheers, it's the exact same opening for 11 seasons, right? Like, you know, whatever, Big Bang Theory or pick a show. Like, it's not very common that they have different intros.
Yeah, it's impressive to me, and it shows the craftsmanship and the intent of the. It's very subtle. It's not like a whole scene like it is in Game of Thrones, where you're like, you know, going through and it's a big sweeping score. It's just like maybe 20 seconds, 30 seconds of intro and the title, and that's it. But it's different, and it's all sort of the same. It's the same, like, notes, I think. But it's a variation on that. So I like it a lot.
Okay. I'll definitely pay more attention next time. I said that last time and I didn't do it, but I'll really do it this time. So after the intro music, the first scene we see is Muro, and she's interrogating Bix because that's where we ended the last episode. Muro is basically explaining to Bix that she talks about how she essentially tortured Pac to get info out of him. She mentions that Pac was paid to keep up the radio. So there was the radio that Bix used in the last episode to broadcast that message that Marva was hurt. She mentions that Bix was the only one that used the radio, so this wasn't, you know, something that the whole town was using. But she did mention that that he was paid to keep up the radio. And it's not clear in the episode who would have paid him, but I sort of got the impression like maybe Luthen was paying him to keep this communication channel open. Did you guys get a better feel on that?
Well, she mentions that Pac revealed all this information after mm-hmm. being tortured, and he said that he attended a separatist meeting 2 years ago, met a woman who I think may be implied to be Clea, Luthen's assistant, possibly. Okay. And she convinced him to take a radio back as a sort of a recruitment to be a liaison to Inferix. The planet, she was using the planet's unique commercial position to acquire stolen Imperial equipment, is what she says about Pac, and that Bix was the only one to actually use the radio, it seems. So that's about all I know.
Yeah, so Muro says she's really grilling Bix. She clearly wants more information on Luthen and the stolen Imperial tech. So she's putting the hard press on Bix. You know, sort of like a cop will arrest a drug dealer, but rather than charge, you know, they'll offer the drug dealer like, hey, I'll give you a pass if you, you know, will squeal on your boss, and then you squeal all the way up the chain until you get the cartel leader. So that was sort of the impression I got with what she was trying to do, was giving Bix an out if she would give her information on Luthen.
It's super devious. Like the way she seems giddy that she's got here. Like she kind of feels like she's gotten to Bix a little bit, and she just like has a snarl on her face.
The very worst thing you can do right now is bore me. You're not going to believe me anyway, are you? No. I suppose not.
So she just moves forward with the interview, quote unquote.
Bix tries to deny that she knew Luthen. I think at one point she says, I only met him once. I don't know who he is. I don't know how to get a hold of him. But Muro calls her out and says, you know, no, that's not true. I know you met him 6 times, which is news to us as the audience. We only saw the one interaction. But so she has more information that she's not letting on to Bix, just to see if Bix will kind of dig herself a hole. I did write down that Muro is super intense in this scene. And she, like you said, she's really creepy and kind of really enjoying her job. And the scene actually ends after she gets, you know, she talks to Bix, and then she walks out the door and she says, she's all yours, Dr. Gorst. And Dr. Gorst is the, you know, whoever the torturer is. And then the scene kind of ends, mm-hmm. and Bix has this, you know, nervous look on her face because she knows she's about to have a bad day. And the next scene, we cut to the prison, and, you know, Cassian and his crew at the prison are continuing to build those hexagonal widgets still. And there's an old guy. His name is Olaf. And in this scene, his hand is hurting and he's having problems using the tools and doing what he needs to do at the table. And he's causing the table to fall behind. And so
Brooks.
It is very much Brooks from Shawshank Redemption. Yes. And so Cassian switches with him. Kino.
Well, he switches with Taga, which is weird. Yeah, he actually switches with Taga. I didn't really totally understand, but that's He doesn't switch with the old dude. He switches with Taga for some
reason. Oh, really? Yeah. Well, so what ends up happening is they end up switching places, and Kino gets mad. He's like, hey, what's going on? You know, you can't be switching around. We got, you know, widgets we got to make. And Cassian, he blames Taga for the switch. He's like, oh, it wasn't my idea. It was Taga's idea. And I was like, isn't Cassian kind of the new guy on the floor? Like, and he's basically throwing Taga under the bus for something that he didn't even do. I mean, it didn't seem like it was a very smart move for the new guy, but.
Okay. I read that the wrong way. I kind of, maybe I misinterpreted that. I thought that was like, he was kind of praising like, all right, whoever stepped up and, you know, switched to assume the harder role, like, good job. Whose idea was it?
Yeah, but that's actually how I read it too, Doug.
Okay.
Yeah,
like, okay.
Trying to be as unnoticeable, I guess, as possible, not really taking credit, but knowing that, and like passing credit. Although it didn't really work because Taga was like, what? That wasn't me.
Yeah, right.
So anyway, that's how I read it as well, Doug.
So that's just a super quick scene to set up that Olaf slash Brooks is having some problems. After that, the next scene we see is we're back with Bix and Dr. Gorst, and Dr. Gorst is beginning his interrogation of Bix. And he mentions that they found the sound of what they believe were dying children or suffering children. And somehow they're able to play this, essentially a recording to people, and it drives them crazy.
Yeah, it was from like a species that they encountered that they like massacred because they just like weren't friendly to their occupation of their planet, I guess. And they made a weird sound, and they specifically used the sound of the children. When they die, they make this weird sound.
Yeah,
and he says they found three communication officers later huddled in various states of emotional distress. Supposedly due to the sound that these creatures are making. And so they've taken the recordings and isolated them and modified them specifically from the children, I guess, so it does like damage.
Yeah, the line is, we've taken the recordings and modified them slightly, layering and adjusting. So they've taken whatever this weird sound is and like kind of cranked it up to 11 to use as a form of torture. So like I had real mixed reaction when I saw this, because like the implication here is like he's going to get out pliers and a blowtorch and just like torture this woman. Right. So when he says he's not going to do that, he's like, I just have this, you know, sound I'm going to let you listen to. Like the part of me was like, oh, OK, good. I don't have to watch this lady get tortured. And then like I started thinking about it and I'm like, This is so much worse because it's all psychological and it's super weird.
Yeah. Yeah. So definitely some Clockwork Orange type vibes going on with this one.
I didn't even think of that, but that's actually, yeah, pretty accurate, I think.
So what Dr. Gorst essentially does is he takes kind of like this motorcycle bicycle helmet looking thing and slides it over Bix's head, and, you know, it has headphones or whatever in it. And then they force her to listen to this sound, and it's going to drive her crazy. And I just wrote down that it was a really unique form of torture. Like it definitely wasn't what I was expecting. And while I was watching this episode, my 13-year-old son looked over at me and he's like, they're torturing her with this weird helmet. He was like, is that thing Bluetooth or is it like, does it have, 'cause there's no wires on it. So apparently the Empire uses Bluetooth and the sound of dying children to torture children or to torture people.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's creative in the way that they don't do a lot of like explicit gore or violence in the show, but they do a great job of making you imagine the worst things that are happening. Like at the prison, you know, we notice we don't see a lot of the things directly up front and close, like the people getting electrocuted and such. You know, it's more hinted at and it's off screen a bit, and it's not, because I think they're trying to avoid being a gory, really violent Star Wars thing, right?
Right.
So I've noticed actually along that line, there's been some themes running through the whole show in regards to the Empire, that it's not overt, like bloody massacre type stuff. But it is technological superiority, just absolute cruelness, cruelty,
intimidation,
cruelty, and arrogance would be another big factor of it. And you see that theme running through like all of the different episodes in return, in regards to how the Empire interacts with the populace, the locals, the prison population, the Aldani survivors. They just have this arrogant cruelty towards them, and even backed up with a technological superiority.
Even the judge and the court system is just so corrupt and, like you said, arrogant.
Yeah, even later on, I mean, I'm skipping ahead a bit, but they find like a random pilot who they know is associated with a rebel group or whatever. And they want to cover their tracks so much to not let them know of their existence. And I mean, if this was another just group that's taking over violently, you could imagine them just torturing him and then like just telling them where they are and bringing every force they have in these directions. I mean, I kind of wonder why these rebel groups even have, if they know anything about them, you know, why aren't they like just wiped out of existence? But yeah, the Empire, I think, takes a lighter touch. I think maybe a lot of, you know, it may be ideological. They may feel like they're the good guys. They're just trying to maintain order. They're not trying to just like straight up kill people right off the bat, I guess. So maybe there's a little bit of that psychological aspect to it, or ideological aspect to it. I don't know. But yeah, that's a great point. I would
say that plays in with the arrogant part of it too. They don't take these, you know, groups as a threat because they're so arrogant that they're superior to them.
I mean, isn't that ultimately their downfall? I mean, their hubris is that they don't take the rebellion seriously. They got a handful of X-Wings that are attacking this Death Star, and they're like, yeah, okay, no big deal. We're going to outgun them so bad. And then clearly what happens is, you know, they blow up the Death Star with a hidden Achilles heel, I guess.
I mean, a small spoiler alert, but ultimately, you know, the Emperor was so convinced that Vader would never turn against him that, I mean,
yeah, that's that a good
became
point.
His downfall. So yeah, pride, arrogance, definitely running themes.
Well, let's get back on track just a little bit. Yeah, so, the next thing we see is just a super quick shot. We're back at the prison, and Cassian has stepped away from the table that they're working at, and he has a section of the wall opened up, like unscrewed. And he's sawing or cutting a pipe that's inside the wall with like a tool that he's fashioned. But then the guards come back, or Kino comes back. I can't remember. And he puts it all away. So you can tell that he's trying to work on something. It's not clear what, but he is definitely working on some sort of escape plan. And in this scene, there's a new prisoner that's brought to the floor by the guards. And so all the prisoners are down on the main floor, and they all put their hands on their head while the guard brings the prisoner down on this little elevator. And Cassian is sort of whispering to the guy standing next to him, and they basically plan an attack on how they're going to attack the guards. And they're going to do it when they bring another prisoner, because the guards, for lack of a better word, their guard is down. So
it almost seems like Cassian, I think he says like, he's talking to this guy that we've never actually seen before. And
yeah,
it seems like they have a rapport, and they've been kind of planning. He says he's talking about going after it right then and now. He says something about like going, we could do it now. I don't know if that's just like me misinterpreting, but
I got that impression too. But clearly, it doesn't happen in that scene. And yeah, you know. So then the next scene, we switch back to, we see Mon Mothma, and she is in the Senate, and she is she's rallying against public order resentencing directive, or the PORD, that affected Cassian in prison and doubled everyone's sentences and gave, it affected everyone's prison sentences. So while she's, you know, giving her impassioned speech in this gigantic Senate, you know, a lot of the other senators and people in the Senate are basically heckling her, and they're talking over her, and they're making it clear that they don't necessarily agree with her stance on the on PORD.
There are some people saying, like, listen to her. And she's right, you know, so there's both happening, but Yeah, you're getting the sense that she's kind of losing faith in the democratic system, I think.
Yeah, right. And the scene ends with Mon Mothma getting in her car, and her driver mentions that Mon Mothma's cousin has arrived and that they are going to go back to her apartment. So then we cut to the prison and we see Taga, who is, and they're in those hallways, and they're, and Taga is doing some more sign language out the window to, you know, whoever his friend is on one of the other floors. And they're basically saying that something major has happened on level two. And so the prisoners start talking about, you know, what may have happened, and start maybe so spreading some rumors. And Kino gets extremely animated and upset, saying, you know, you don't know what's going on. This is just a rumor. Like, don't get all spun up. But like, I wrote down that Kino was more upset than I felt like he should have been for just, you know, some talk that they were talking about. So I feel like Kino has a little bit more insight into this than he's letting on.
Well, it's an indication. He says, how many hands does it take for one word to get down through here? And that's an indication that he's familiar with their communication system of like doing the sign language. What I imagine, I guess, is they're doing these signings during these hall runs. But there's levels and units way far away. And so like news from this level two is very far away. There's no way for them to get the information fast enough.
Is he complaining about, like, you know, this is a game of telephone, like this has gone through 14 people, like it might not be accurate?
Yeah. Yes.
Oh, okay. Okay.
Yeah, basically. Yeah. And that reveals that Kino understands what's going on, and he knows that they're having this secret communication.
Okay.
Yeah. So you get a sense that there's more to him.
I mean, he is a prisoner. He's been around. Probably rose up through the ranks, you know, started at a table working one of the shifts and then rose up and acquired his job as the floor commander, so to speak.
Yeah, I think I got just more of a friendlier viewpoint because I thought he was just a hard ass that like wouldn't let anything slide like that. But this reveals that, no, he knows about it. He's not doing anything about it. You know, he's more friendly to it, really.
So I'm with you. I picked up on the hard ass thing, but I kind of saw it as he was being a hard ass to try and keep them safe and protect them and, you know, not end up getting everybody fried due to negligence.
Yeah. I will say Andy Serkis is the star of this episode. Like, he does such a great job of acting out this slow reveal, and then you actually see him change later. I mean, he does such a great job. I think
he's really intense, and he is. You're right. I agree. I think a lot of there was a lot of Reddit posts about how great the Kino character was, and so I agree.
Yeah, no argument there. Andy Serkis is amazing in this.
He's kind of amazing in pretty much everything he does. So,
oh yeah, no, he's a solid actor for sure.
So the next scene we see, we cut back to Mon Mothma's apartment where she's going to meet her cousin. Mon Mothma walks in and lo and behold, Vel is there and she's all dressed up and fancy. So the big reveal here is that Vel and Mon Mothma are related. They are cousins. And again, I wrote down that Vel cleans up really well because she was pretty plain and, you know, even dirty on when she was on Aldani, but she's kind of hot when she's all cleaned up and dressed up and her hair was done. So that was a kind of a 180 degrees change for that character.
Yeah. The theory that she's, you know, connected to a wealthy family, an important family. I don't know who said that or who picked up on that.
I don't know who it was either. It probably wasn't important.
We shouldn't get
pretty sure it was Cinta, wasn't it? Didn't Cinta call her like a rich girl playing rebel?
I was trying to fish for compliments because yes, I picked up on that because Cinta, says like, you know, you listen to the previous episode, fan base, you understand.
So Vel has brought a fancy gold dress for Mon Mothma's daughter. And Mon Mothma basically, she's a little hesitant about it, you know, because her daughter's, I don't know, 15 or whatever. And the dress is slightly revealing. And, she was like, well, I don't know if your dad's going to let you wear that. And her daughter basically says, he lets me wear whatever I want. You know, so there's clearly like mother-daughter tension there. Like you get the impression that Mon Mothma is not the favorite parent for this girl.
Is it wrong of me to just kind of say I sort of hate Mon Mothma's daughter?
No, I don't think so. She's definitely a spoiled teenager.
Yeah, she really...
She's a little entitled. Well, I mean, she's a rich girl, right? I mean, her parents are loaded. Her mom's a senator. Like, she doesn't have anything to worry about. She's the Paris Hilton of the Star Wars universe.
I hate Perrin more, but... and I think that's more of the influence that the daughter's getting is from Perrin. And I think there's a dynamic here that is really just... I'm impressed. But the idea that Mon Mothma kind of has a secret and she can't be truly honest with her family. She can't like come clean with what she's doing has been a part of the schism, I think, in her family. And so that might be one of the reasons why they have a bad relationship with like her husband. And then, you know, as a result of that, her husband and her and Mon Mothma have a kind of a competing relationship with their daughter rather than a partnership with their daughter.
Yeah, for sure.
I mean, it's just great writing, I think.
The scene ends with Mon Mothma and Vel having a conversation, and she basically asks Vel, you know, what have you been doing? Please tell me that you're being safe. So the implication here is that Vel knows, or Mon Mothma knows that Vel is working for Luthen, but she doesn't know what Vel is doing. So she has no idea that Vel was involved with the Aldani raid. So they're, whatever Mon Mothma and Luthen are doing, they are not necessarily keeping each other in the loop. That's clearly on purpose. I assume it's plausible deniability, but... It's just worth knowing that Mon Mothma doesn't understand the full inner workings of whatever, you know, organization that Luthen is building.
Yeah, she's kind of a small player in kind of the grand scheme of things. She's more of just like a money source, it seems, kind of.
It is kind of interesting to me how, like, here you have one of the central figures of the entire rebellion, and even she is so kept in the dark that she doesn't even know her cousin is another central figure.
Yeah, that's a good point. I mean, Mon Mothma is, I mean, isn't she, at least in New Hope, I mean, she's pretty much the leader of the entire rebellion, right?
Yeah, I'm pretty sure.
Yeah, okay.
She has a much more leadership role. And I think at this stage, yeah, she's not, I mean, the rebellion is very disorganized, so it wouldn't make sense for a senator to like hop on board, but she's left out of the loop because she is public a figure. She's a resource, like I said. So yeah, hopefully, I think in the Clone Wars animated stuff, they show her transition from senator, like she resigns or something during the show. I really hope they show that in this show as well. I would really like to see her transformation.
The next scene,
I wholeheartedly expect she'll get her own spin-off show. Like, we'll be watching season one of Mothma next year or something.
Mothma.
who would be in the buddy comedy with Mon Mothma? There you go. It's like a Tay Kilma and Mon Mothma just like buddy cop spit.
Romance, like a affair type thing. I that's what I'm imagining.
All right, well, that comes up later. So
brilliant. Someone call a Gilroy. Let's write, get this a Gilroy out.
Yeah. Get one of the Gilroy brothers.
Tony Gilroy, we know you're listening. Give us a call. We'll write a couple episodes for you. So the next scene we see is we're back in the prison, and Cassian and Kino are in their respective cells, and the floor, I believe, is on. And so they're across from each other, and Cassian is asking Kino about the amount of guards and how the shift rotation works. He's trying to get information out because clearly he's planning some sort of a prison break. Kino mentions that he has 217 days left, so he is not interested in entertaining any of Cassian's discussions about a prison break. He just wants to finish out his his prison term and get back to his normal life. Cassian tells him, his line is, "We're nothing to them. We're cheaper than droids and easier to replace." So he's not entirely convinced that he's going to just get out of prison and walk away. And this is where, again, the title of the episode is "Nobody's Listening!" exclamation point. So Kino basically shuts Cassian down and tells him to shut up because he's worried that perhaps the guards are listening and they're going to hear this plan and they're going to crack down on them. But at one point, I think Cassian starts yelling. He's like, "No one listens. No one cares. They're not interested in anything we have to do. We're just, you know, cogs in this machine to build whatever they're building." The guards really don't have a vested interest in whether or not the prisoners are trying to escape.
Yeah, they don't care. They're nothing. And he also mentions really quickly, like, Melshi's right in this whole thing. So Melshi is the one who's at their table. And there was another earlier scene in the episode where Melshi's talking to Cassian about, like, "Hey, just forget it. Don't look at the numbers." And then, Koi, I forgot his name, Circus's character,
Loy.
Yeah. He breaks it up. He doesn't want Melshi talking to Cassian at all. So it feels to me like Melshi has an important role. There's another one, a scene later where that, like, a little bit happens with Melshi that just makes me question something with him. So I just want to note that. Yeah,
there's almost like a Nurse Ratched and I totally forgot the main character of One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest vibe. Randall Patrick McMurphy. So he basically, where Kino's trying to keep this guy in line. So clearly Cassian is a troublemaker. He's trying to stir things up with the other prisoners, and Kino is more interested in keeping the peace, so to speak. So
also want to point out Cassian's reaction, his anger here. Definitely kind of mirrors in, what was it, episode 3, I think, where he was talking about getting the Starpath unit and how, you know, they're so apathetic, you know, they don't even care. You just dress like one of them and walk right in and they won't pay any attention to you. Like, that same sort of frustration and anger is sort of mirrored in this "nobody's listening" scene.
Yeah.
The next thing we see, we're back at the ISB and they're doing their, you know, weekly roundtable meeting or whatever. Miro mentions that she has a line on some stolen merch that she has linked to Maya Pei. And if you'll remember, Maya Pei was one of the other separatists when Luthen was talking to Saw Gerrera. So there's a lot of things going on. It's not, the ISB is looking into more people than just Cassian. They mentioned that they have tracked Cassian back to Ferrix. They know that he went back to Ferrix and that he had money in his pocket and he was clean shaven. They really kind of hammered home the clean shaven. I don't know why that was a thing, but they mentioned that that Cassian was spotted on Ferrix with money and clean shaven.
Apparently the soldiers on Aldani were clean shaven, but even then that does seem like a weak link, but that seems to be like the killer
really?
To like connect Aldani with the Ferrix incident. And this gets them very excited.
Yeah. Like him being clean shaven was the smoking gun.
Yeah.
Huh,
yeah.
Weird.
Yeah.
So there's a quick discussion about why, what's the main ISB guy's name, Wolf.
One there that's in this meeting is Partagas. Wolf Yularen is not in this one, but yeah.
Okay, he asks Miro why you didn't interrogate the mother, talking about Marva, because clearly she's got information about Cassie, and that would have been why he went back to Ferrix. But Miro mentions she's our bait. And she's essentially implying that she's too old and frail to interrogate, that if we did try and interrogate her with these sounds of these dying children, that she would just crack and it wouldn't be worth it because they wouldn't get what they wanted out of her. So then we cut back to the prison and they're in the hallways, they're in the lines and they're doing, you know, the sign language between the levels, I guess, again. And Taga gets mentioned that all of Unit 2-5 got fried and they are all dead. So we don't know exactly how many people this is, but if you can assume that it's a floor or a team like where Cassian and Kino are, I mean, we're talking at least 50 people. So
yeah, another like horrific event, but done off camera.
Yeah, a massacre, right?
Yeah, horrific thing.
Yep. The rumor that Taga gets is that that floor was making trouble and the Empire killed him just to shut him up. But so Kino loses it here. Actually, I believe it's Taga who tells Olaf that all the people were set free because Olaf is kind of losing his mind at this point. He's kind of out of it. And so Taga tells him, you know, to keep him calm and not get him all amped up. He says, oh, no, don't worry. Nothing happened on 2.5. They were all set free. And Kino gets pissed. And he just turns around and just punches Taga in the gut. And basically, I think his line was, it's all rumor. We heard nothing. So I thought it was really kind of like, Taga's trying to do the right thing. He's trying to help just keep Olaf calm. And Kino's just not having it, which I thought was strange.
Yeah, this is a very chaotic scene. I think they get some information from another floor, from a guy called Zinska. And so I think it's another unit leader comes and talks to Kino Loy. I can never remember that name. It's weird.
The next scene we see, and this is my favorite scene in the entire episode right here. So we see Cyril, and he is eating dinner with his mom.
I thought it was breakfast because he's got like breakfast? Milk, the cereal thing. Maybe sure. It's like eating cereal at all hours. Yeah.
And she's just, you know, nagging him and just going to town on him. And he gets frustrated with her. And he says, I know you've been in my room. And she's like, I'm just cleaning. And he was like, well, I know you've been in my private box. So he has some sort of box in his room with who knows what's in it. And his mom is like going through it. So they're having like this very like typical like mom and 14-year-old kid kind of conversation, which I thought was hilarious.
I wouldn't call it typical, but I guess the dynamics are because like she's, you know, like sneaking on him, not respecting his privacy, but like. It's super weird, you know, he says coldly, I have ways of knowing. And she's like saying like, oh, I've put so much work into you. You know, what is the return on my investment? You know?
Yeah, that was so the line is, yeah. So basically his mom is mad that he's not more grateful that she got him this job and she bailed him out. And he's just, you know, grumpy around the apartment. And so her line is, what's the return on my investment? The shadow of a son, a tenant, a stranger. So she's just mad that he's not contributing around the house and being more happy now. And as a parent of two teenage boys, like this conversation could have come out of my house, like on any given day. Like I'm always telling my kids, like, this is not a hotel. Like you actually got to contribute. You got to do some chores. You got to talk to people. You can't just be grumpy the whole time. So
The dialogue for Eddie, his mom, is just insane. There's another one that I wrote down, which I think they're just utilizing her her ability as a pretty good actor. But there's one line where she says, what if I'd let your neglect drive me insane? Imagine that. Look back months ago when you could easily ignore me. Imagine I'd cracked under the weight of your neglect. Imagine I'd cracked and wasn't here now to pick up the pieces. Like
she's just putting like the most crazy guilt trip on
him. It's like Shakespearean stuff. Yeah. Yeah.
So I love it because like Cyril is having none of it. So at one point he picks up his cereal or whatever and he slurps it super loudly just to drown her out because he doesn't want to listen to her nag him anymore. It was fantastic. And like she continues to nag him. And so like kind of out of the corner of his mouth, he goes, I've been promoted.
Look back just months ago when you could easily ignore me. Imagine I'd cracked under the weight of your neglect. Imagine I'd cracked and wasn't here now to pick up the pieces.
I've been promoted.
And then like her like whole face changes. She was like, what? Oh, Uncle Harlow will be so pleased. It was so hilarious.
It's weird. It's just weird AF, man.
Yes. The next scene, we cut back to Mon Mothma's apartment, and they are eating lunch or dinner or whatever. So this is Mon Mothma's family, and Vel is still there because she's visiting. And at one point, I think it's the daughter that mentions that Tae Kolma was Mon Mothma's old boyfriend in grade school, is what she said. So Tae Kolma and Mon Mothma go way back, apparently. They have some a long history, and perhaps even romantically, as much as you can be in grade school. Mon Mothma's husband, Perrin, is talking to Vel, you know, like trying to catch up, like, what have you been up to? And Vel, I don't even remember what she says. She just kind of plays it down. But Perrin says, well, at least you've not gone political, Vel. All the interesting people are getting very tedious these days. And the note that I wrote was, he has no patience for being political. His wife is a freaking senator, dude. I mean, like, what do you want? Like, you just basically slapped her entire career in the face.
Yeah, that's actually a pretty cold backhanded.
Yeah, it was super kind of jerky move. The scene ends with Vel essentially leaving. They've had finished their meal or whatever. And so the implication here is, or now it's clear to the audience, that both Mon Mothma and Vel are rich, but they've both chosen to fight the Empire. And at one point, you know, I think Mon Mothma basically says, you know, why are we doing this? Like, we're rich. Like, we could just essentially go retire on a beach and let somebody else fight this fight, you know, and not have to put up with all this crap. And Vel had a really cool line I wrote down was, we've chosen a side. We're fighting against the dark. We're making something of our lives.
Yeah, there's also a quote where she quotes Cinta, I think. The Empire doesn't rest, Mon. She's like re-quoting Cinta's quote to Mon. The rebellion comes first. We take what's left. So, yeah, it's kind of interesting how she's taken a lot of inspiration from Cinta. And then I think Vel is sort of the more aggressive rebellion between her and Mon. So, yeah.
You think, I mean, she picked up a gun and went and robbed a Imperial outpost. So, yeah, I would say she's the more aggressive rebel between the two.
Oh, okay. Yeah, that's good evidence. Yeah, you're right.
I mean, I think there's definitely an argument to be made that you can perhaps affect, you know, people more politically than you can by just walking in and robbing a bank. So,
and clearly,
I think that's what Mon Mothma's doing, right? I mean, they're both working on the same side, just going at it two totally different ways.
Yeah, her sacrifice also is different. So, there's a shot at the end of the scene where it's like a wide shot of Mon Mothma's back pulling away in this very ornate, like, entryway. I don't know if you guys noticed it, but it was like a beautiful shot as Vel's walking away and she's just standing there cold, just very still. And it seems purposeful to me. She appears like as an ornament or a statue, like frozen in her constraint. So I think it's just supposed to present her situation in she's just sort of really stuck between a rock and a hard place where, you know, she's damned if she does more to help and she's damned if she doesn't because it, you know, it doesn't serve her purposes. She has to play up all of these, you know, with her family. She's really struggling. And, you know, so they're trying to communicate, even though she's well off, even though she's rich, she is sacrificing as well. So
it's a bit of a gilded cage type of scenario. Like, yeah. Yes, she's rich and living the fancy life, but she's absolutely kind of a her own sort of tortured prisoner of the Empire.
I also not get the impression that Mon Mothma is happy in her life.
No. God, no. But I also want to point out there was a subtle thing that happened right before that framing. She's talking to her sister and you know, they're hugging. And then her driver comes around the corner and picks up the bags. Did her driver, who we have already basically been told is an Imperial spy, did he hear any of that conversation?
Wait, where were we told that he was an Imperial spy? That was my guess.
Yeah,
I mean, it was a solid guess, though, right?
Yeah, they hinted at it. Yeah, multiple times they hint at it.
Okay. Yeah, her and Luthen go through that whole fake show of her buying a gift to kind of throw the driver off. So My question to you two, do you think that's going to amount to anything? Is the driver going to go report that conversation?
I didn't catch that. I didn't know if he was in earshot. I assume that Mon Mothma would be careful in that situation, but maybe not. And maybe she just didn't notice, but it didn't seem like there was any reaction to like, oh, crap, he's like right there. But could be.
So the next scene we see, this is my second favorite scene in the episode, is we see that Cyril is basically kind of like leaning against this pillar and he's watching people walk by. And then you realize that he's been waiting for Miro and he sees Miro come walking. So this is essentially outside of the ISB and he's been waiting for her to show up and he'd kind of just like fanboys out on her. And he thanks her for the promotion. So whatever Miro did, she pulled some strings and got Cyril a promotion.
Well,
and
she just cleared his name, I guess, gave him a clean bill of health. She didn't say anything nice, just said like, all right, he helped us a little bit. He didn't screw up, basically. So I think that was enough.
Do you take that for face value or is she withholding information because that's what she does?
No, I think she's withholding information. I think she sees in Cyril like he is completely obsessed with Cassian and she is too. And so I think she's pulling some strings. I think that they're going to have a relationship moving forward and they're going to team up on Cassian and go after him together because they're both crazy, you know, laser focused on this guy. That's a guess.
No, I remind you, she did that whole two-sided approach when she brought Bix in for questioning.
Oh, right. She
was like, no, leave him here, I want her to see. And then as soon as Bix walked in, oh, I'm so sorry you had to see that, get him out of here. So she could be doing the same thing to Cyril here, like,
wow,
absolutely don't leave or don't keep following up on this. And then she's still secretly rewarding him and feeding him information.
Well, I mean, like, Cyril is just, like, completely in love with her. Like, I really expected him to get down on his knees and start, like, kissing her boots, right? Like,
oh, I think she wants that to happen.
Yeah, like, well, at one...
He says, being in your presence, I've realized that life is worth living. I realize that if nothing else, there's justice and beauty in the galaxy. If I just keep going, Cyril says to her... I got it differently, completely differently. You guys are going deep on this, like, two-faced.
They're going to end up together, like, 1,000%.
I don't disagree with that, but I still think that Daedra views him as a gnat, like someone so beneath him or beneath her, not worth her time. Like, she just kind of barely said, okay, he's fine to his job, and maybe that was enough to get him a promotion. I don't think he's like grooming him for like a special position at this point. I think she's freaked out by this whole encounter. She's like almost embarrassed.
Yeah, she secretly loves it.
But she's like, into it.
Just being in your presence, I realized that life was worth living. I realized that if nothing else, there was justice and beauty in the galaxy. And if I just kept going... Perhaps my deranged belief that there was something better fated for me in the future was a dream worth clinging to.
I could have you arrested. You were aware of that.
I want what you want. I sense it. I know it.
You're out of your mind.
Wasn't that like just the weirdest pickup line ever, though, where he was like, life is worth living because you're in it and there is justice in the world? Like, that was so...
Well, yeah, given there's no indication that she has any interest in him, he is going all out. It's so cringy. But yes, it is a great, creepy, weird, beautiful interaction. Yeah.
Ultimately, Miro ends up rejecting him. She doesn't give him any... she doesn't say anything nice to him at all. She basically just says, at one point she asks him, are you stalking me? And she basically tells him like, don't follow me anymore. Don't talk to me. Like, I don't want anything to do with you.
She has like a snarl, like that classic Empire snarl, like get away from me. Like, I'm not with you at all at this point that she cares about him, but, I guess we'll see. I think maybe it'll get there, but...
Miro says, as she walks away, she says, you come near me again, you pursue any of this, and I swear I'll have you in a cage on the outer rim. So she's just playing hard to get.
Yeah, no, totally. That's just how she flirts.
So, but a fantastic scene, and both of those actors just did an amazing job in that scene. Like the tension between them and like the chemistry is just like, it was fantastic. So
I agree.
Yeah. The next scene cuts to Takehoma and Mon Mothma talking about the accounts. So Mon Mothma, it's not clear exactly what she did, but somehow, somewhere, the 400,000 credits from the Aldani heist showed up in an account and then later disappeared. And that is going to cause problems because now there is a paper trail where this money came in and went out and doesn't have any explanation. Takehoma mentions that that they're going to need a banker to help them cover this paper trail. And he brings up a name of Davo Skuldin. And Mon Mothma doesn't want anything to do with that person. She knows who that is. And she says he's a thug. But she the scene ends with it kind of looks like she's going to be forced to, you know, bring in whoever this is to cover up this paper trail, because otherwise, you know, it's going to bring her down.
Yeah, there's some interesting interplay between them. It seemed like Mon was kind of describing the problem, and Tay was like, yeah, they're going to, you know, they're probably going to do this sweep into your accounts. And she's like, well, I would need a loan. And Tay's like, yeah, you know, I have some people. And she's like, no, no way. You're not thinking of him. And he's like, yeah, this guy, you know, he's a thug. And she's like cold about it. But and he's like, yeah, you know, I kind of already set up a meeting. I already talked to him. She's kind of leading her along to this ultimately conclusion that they kind of have to come to, even though it's a very bad conclusion when it seems.
So I don't know. What's the implication here that Mon Mothma doesn't know how to hide money, or she doesn't know how to move money from A to B?
It's their money laundering, right? And the Empire is tightening their sweeps or their investigations, audits or whatever of these different of people's accounts. And they're worried it has. I think that she says something along the lines, it hasn't happened yet. But Tay's like, yeah, it's coming. So they have to do something. You know, this audit is, they're basically preparing for an audit. So they need to have a loan to kind of paper things out. It's money laundering.
The significance of this to me is this is kind of a sort of point of no return. Like, up until now, she's kept everything quiet. She's had deniability. Nothing could really be traced. Nothing could be tracked. And now it's she's a criminal. She's going to have to start working with criminals or thugs or whatever she referred to them as. And she's starting to kind of realize, like, yeah, this happened. I am a rebel now. I am against the Empire. You know, my cousin is all in. You know, Luthen is all in. She's kind of realizing, yeah, I'm a criminal now.
She's been riding the fence a little bit. And I think you're right. This is the scene where she realizes that she's in deep.
Well, especially since Tay kind of already talked to this guy and said that he has to meet her there at her house. So
that's right. She says, yeah, you can't bring him here.
Yes. And so this is, I think you're right, Doug. This is kind of the moment where she realizes she kind of has no choice. And now she has to kind of like, her reputation's going to be tarnished because of this meeting. It's going to be kind of public. He's requiring to come to meet her there at her house on Coruscant. So,
you know what she needs is she needs a criminal lawyer, but not a criminal lawyer, a criminal lawyer. Nobody is Breaking Bad reference. Come on.
I knew you were going to a Better Call Saul direction, right? But
That's a different universe. That's a totally different. We're not bridging cinematic universes between Star Wars and Better Call Saul. Fair enough. All right. So we are almost at the end of the episode. The penultimate scene, we cut back to the ISB roundtable, and Miro and whoever the head of the ISB are discussing that they have picked up a pilot that has connection to separatists.
Oh, I just got your joke, Doug. Sorry, I'm really slow. A criminal lawyer. A lawyer who's a criminal.
Thank you. That makes it funnier.
I'm dumb dumb. Sorry.
So the ISB has picked up this pilot. They mentioned, so they know that he's connected to the separatists. They picked him up. He was alone, and they picked him up before he has radioed home. So no one knows he's missing. So they have an opportunity with this pilot to perhaps get closer to the separatists. They mention that the pilot was one of Krieger's guys. And again, if you remember, Krieger was one of the separatists that Luthen talks to Saw Gerrera about. And again, this is another scene that, like the last episode. So as Miro and the main guy are talking, Miro's assistant comes into the room. He shows up late and he apologizes. You know, I don't remember, some paperwork held him up, and it has no bearing on the scene. Like, there's no, in any quote unquote real show, all of those characters would have already been in the room and they would have been having a discussion and it would have been, you know, smooth from A to B. But in this show, the writers tend to do this thing where they flesh out these characters and they have little quirks or little, they humanize the reality of, you know, this guy got held up because he couldn't find the paperwork he needed, or who knows. It added nothing to the story, but I think it's really cool that they give these characters a little more than just like a perfectly, you know, set up scene from start to finish.
Yeah, it seems like they're really working against the clock. They're really hectic. And that's a great observation. Yeah.
So what they're discussing basically is that perhaps they can fake this pilot's death and, you know, leave him in the cockpit of the ship. And that might draw Krieger out because he won't know that it's that he's been captured. Then perhaps he'll come to investigate, you know, why this pilot is missing. So they're potentially going to use this pilot as bait to try and capture Krieger. And the final scene is we are back in the prison, and Cassian and his crew are building some more widgets. Olaf has a major headache. He is exhausted and he basically almost passes out. And I think, you know, Cassian basically holds him up at one point so that he doesn't hit the floor and Kino doesn't freak out. So,
yeah, doesn't he pull out a pocket knife and like carve "Brooks was here" into the widget they're making or something like that?
Again, we're not combining the Star Wars and Shawshank Redemption cinematic universes. I feel like he could have. It could have happened, but it didn't. So right about then, I think what the shift ends or whatever, and Kino is basically talking about what table won and what table lost. And I don't remember which table loses, but, you know, whatever, table 7. And all of all of that table gets shocked. And so, again, it happens off screen. So you don't see any of this violence. You don't see any of the, you know, the people being uncomfortable. What you see instead is Cassian essentially holding Olaf. And you see that table's reaction to this other table getting shocked. You hear it. And you hear them being unhappy about being shocked, and you see the reaction on this table's face. And it almost makes it worse, honestly, because it's just so much creepier to not see it and instead see someone's reaction to it.
Yeah, they're wincing. And yeah.
It was clearly a pretty gnarly shock.
So this is a small detail for me, but it kind of bugged me, and it made me question a couple of things. When they announce the results, like Kino comes in and he's like on program, and everyone stops and puts their hands on their head. But obviously, Brooks Olaf wasn't able to do that because he's basically having a stroke right there.
Yeah.
So they said at the very beginning of the whole prison thing, like on program, if you're not on program, you're going to get fried. And he doesn't get fried. So why not? Like,
I sort of got the impression that, I don't know if Kino necessarily saw, like, they were kind of trying to hide him, weren't they?
Yeah, but is Kino the guy that would be frying him? Is that up to Kino? How would Kino have that sort of authority and technology to be frying Olaf? Wouldn't one of the guards be watching? And if the guards aren't watching, why do they give a crap about being on program?
Yeah, that's a good question.
I don't think he has the authority to do that, but he could be the one that would report it. Some report like misbehavior or somebody's not on program. He definitely, that could be the case, but as we're learning, Kino is not necessarily, you know, the evil overlord that he might have purported to be earlier. You know, he may have caught a glimpse of it. I didn't catch that either. Like, there it was a fumble with Olaf, and they were kind of trying to lift him up, and not sure exactly if Kino saw what was going on, but I think that might be the dynamic where Kino could be the tattletale, so to speak.
Interesting.
So, okay. Olaf is essentially completely out of it at this point. He can't walk. He can't even really talk. So the shift is over, and they are dragging Olaf back to his cell. They're going to hopefully get him some rest and get him restored. But Kino realizes that Olaf is very sick, and they call for a medic, and all the prisoners are in the hallway, and everybody.
A med tech.
Okay. The one thing I noted, and maybe I just haven't seen this before, was that all of the prisoners are barefoot, and maybe I just hadn't noticed their feet before. But it's very clear that 100% of the prisoners that are in this floor, they don't even have socks or shoes, or they have nothing on. They are barefoot. We did mention obviously that the guards have boots, but the prisoners are very much barefoot.
That was a detail when they were transporting them into the prison. They were on the transport, and the guard said, "Take off your shoes." And everyone had to kick off their shoes. Okay. Everybody at the prison is barefoot except the guards, who have the big snowboard boot type things.
Yeah, that's their method of control. That's literally the only way they control the prisoners, is because everyone is barefoot.
They I mean, that was definitely implied. I guess maybe this was the first scene I noticed where they actually had bare feet.
And some of the guards don't have the boots. Some just like are normal shoes, you know, because Cassian's pointing this out with his friend earlier. He's like, oh, they don't have boots. Or he's touching the rail in that one scene where they're bringing in the new dude. So it's not as like black and white. All the guards are protected. All the, you know, the prisoners, all the railings, everything is not necessarily wired, so they're figuring stuff out.
The one thing I noted in this scene is that all the prisoners are wearing white jumpsuits that have an orange stripe down the side, so they all have the exact same uniform. When the med tech shows up, he has a white uniform with a blue stripe down the side, so he is visually different than the prisoners.
Very clearly still a prisoner himself.
Mm-hmm. Right. So the medic shows up, and Kino basically is trying to tell him, like, you got to give him something just to, you know, get him through. He only has 40 shifts left. So Kino is very interested in getting this guy to the end of his sentence so that he can get out and live the rest of his life. The doctor basically has to give some unfortunate news and says, no, I'm sorry, he just had a massive stroke. There's nothing I can do for him. I'm basically going to give him this and euthanize him. And I think at one point the doctor even says, trust me, you know, in 2 weeks you'll be wishing you could have had what I'm going to give Olaf.
Yeah, that's good bedside manner. There was a quick thing that I referenced earlier. I just wanted to note that Kinoid tells Melshi to go now. Like, right. He like specifically talks to him and says, get out of here. So it just seems weird that they like made this scene, and it seems like Melshi is someone that is going to be important. So I don't know. I just want to point that out, but this whole thing is very dark.
So right now, Cassian is kind of freaked out because Olaf is essentially dying right in front of his eyes. And so he asked the doctor, because the doctor has clearance, you know, I think in the entire facility, not just on this floor. And he says, he asks what happened on level 2, and he's really pressing the doctor, like, you know, we heard about essentially this massacre, like, can you tell us about it? And the doctor doesn't really want to bite. He looks at Kino and he says, you'll want to keep your men in line. And he's hesitant to give up some information, but ultimately he does. And what he said was, and this took me, I had to listen to it two or three times to fully understand what he was talking about. What he said was that a man was released from four and ended up on two. So the implication here is that one of the prisoners ended their sentence from level four, but instead of them letting him go, he just showed up on a different floor and they were going to make him continue to work. So he was not released from prison. When the prisoners on level two realized what had happened, they started freaking out and essentially rioted because they have no incentive to keep working, because even if they finish their sentence, they're just going to get stuck in here. And when the prisoners or when the guards realized what was going on, they essentially just killed the entire floor to quell this uprising.
Yeah.
So this is where it takes a really dark turn, is that I think Kino and Cassian kind of look at each other and they realize, you know, it doesn't matter how many widgets we make. It doesn't matter how smoothly this floor runs. I'm not getting out of this place. You know, I'm going to die here just like Olaf. And he didn't go well. I mean, clearly he was not happy in his last couple days. So this it ends on a very down, dark note. And the last line or two lines of the episode are, I believe Cassian and Kino are back in their cells again. And Cassian...
They're just walking away from the scene.
Exactly.
And Cassian immediately asks him the question again.
Yeah.
That he's been trying to get out of Kino.
How many guards on each level?
Never more than 12.
Yeah, so Cassian says, how many guards on each level? And you have to remember, Kino has not entertained this at all. And so Cassian asks again, and Kino just kind of defeated. He says, never more than 12.
Oh, I need to clarify that. You said defeated. I don't see defeated in his eyes. I see pissed off.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I see him like losing his cool. To point out, too, his whole reasoning for not wanting to talk earlier was because he was afraid the guards might be listening. They're saying this as they're walking down the hall away from the guard. He knows a guard is there. He doesn't care anymore. He is pissed.
Okay.
That's what I take from it.
It was a fantastic ending, you know, because that's it. And then the episode ends and the credits roll. And I thought it was a great ending. I mean, it was dark, you know, because it ends with them realizing that they are screwed and they're not going to get out of here no matter what they do. But it's clearly setting up. I mean, again, so we're in episode two of a 3-episode arc. So I think we're going to see in episode 3 or an episode, the next one, which is 10, is going to be some sort of massive prison break or a riot or whatever. And I am on board for it because this looks great.
Yeah.
Do you want to do ratings? Doug, you want to go first or last?
You know, I went last time, so let me go ahead and kick things off.
Okay.
We've seen it a couple of times with the way they do the 3-episode arcs. Episode 2 kind of ends with, you know, the fuse starting to get lit, and you know that the finale of the arc is going to just blow up and be huge. So this one ends the same way. I feel the same vibe I had after episode 2 and episode 5. Yeah, 5. It's going to be cool. I'm really excited about the next one. I'm looking forward to the prisoners just revolting, and yeah, it should be a good one. Loving the anticipation, loving the excitement and build up. I'll be honest, a little bit of the Mon Mothma stuff is starting to get a little slow and tedious to me. So I'm not going to give this episode a perfect score, but I'd say it's a solid 8 for me.
All right, I'll give Jason the last word. So I'll go. I loved this episode. I thought it was fantastic. I mean, the scenes with Cyril and his mom were, you know, chef's kiss. They were just fantastic. The scene with Cyril and Miro where he's, you know, flirting with her in like the weirdest way possible was just amazing. You know, the way the episode ends with Cassian and Kino basically deciding that they're going to riot and overthrow the prison. There's just so much to like in this episode. And I was surprised that I liked it as much as I did, because, again, it's a middle episode. It's just it's a build up to the next, you know, the crescendo that is coming in the next episode. But I loved it start to finish. 9 out of 10.
Wow. That's quite a high score. Yeah.
Says the guy who gave the last episode a 10 out of 10.
The last episode set up this whole situation. It did a lot of work to get where we are. This episode to me is a very much a bridge episode. It feels very much like a middle episode. It has some great scenes, like you say, like some amazing dialogue. I looked at the transcript on this one. It's the first, I know you recommended looking at the transcript. It helps out, and it totally does. And I was looking at some of the dialogue, even like sort of the exposition, like dialogue where Daedra's interrogating Vix and telling him about Hack and the whole history of the transmitter. It's all really well written. The scenes with Eddie, Karn's, Cyril's mom, are just ridiculously weirdly.
Huh? Cyril's mom is named Eddie?
Yeah.
Oh, I didn't know that. That's weird. Okay.
She seems like an Eddie, you know? Anyway, yes, there's some great stuff I've never seen before. So it's a very highly, you know, it's a good episode. I give it a 7.5, you know, so it's very good, solidly good. But it doesn't, you know, doesn't do a lot. What it does do great, like, as you mentioned, it, you know, gives us this turning point of hope. We had a very dark episode. We had like kind of like no end in sight, you know, like an Empire Strikes Back, so to speak, you know, very dark ending. And then we have a new episode that gives you, that ramps up towards what, you know, is going to happen, which is Cassian will escape somehow. We know that. So it does that very well. It does it, you know, very eloquently and with amazing characters. And Andy Serkis is goddamn amazing. Like,
yes, he is. Yes.
The intensity that's happening with that Ulof scene at the end, when the medic won't answer the question about what happened on level two, and something about what the medic says like triggers him so much that he just like start, you could tell the fire is ignited in him, and he's like, fuck it, you tell me what's going on, I'm not gonna play nice anymore. He does such a great job, and he's not covered in like prosthetics or like motion capture stuff, which is what usually Andy Serkis is dealing with. He's just him as an actor. So plenty of good things to say, but you know, this episode didn't have to do a lot. It just had to move the story forward and do some cool stuff. 7.5. Sorry, I went long there.
All right, that's it. We'll see you next time. Jason, wrap us up.
Logic gate out. Is that fine?
No, we gotta do the whole thing all over again.